Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. And I have a very special guest joining us via Skype today. It's just me and Randy Sutton. For those of you not familiar, Randy Sutton is pretty much the voice of American law enforcement today in the media. You've seen him on Waters World and Fox and Friends. I grew up as a young cop watching Randy crush crime and suppress evil on the show Cops. it's kind of a trip to speak to you because I could tell you, you know, during my early career, you know, well, in my younger days, my dad was a cop. I watched Cops. I asked him, why didn't he watch it? And he said, because Cops is the greatest example of how not to do the job most of the time. But, you know, there were some certain people on it that were squared away. And Randy Sutton was one of them. He's one of those cops that I looked up to. Welcome, Randy. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And you know what? I'm just like your dad. I don't watch cop shows because it frustrates me so much to watch some of the tactics that are used. It's just better if I don't.
You know, it's interesting. We've talked about that. Is that police work done well is not interesting TV.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So it's only when we forget to throw our cars in park at the end of a pursuit, or we're not watching the guy's hands and we let him get too far away. So welcome. I'm really appreciate you coming on. This is our first foray out into this podcast world. And I wanted to make it a forum where police officers and firefighters and veterans could tell their stories directly from their own mouths and hopefully create a public understanding of what they go through from their own perspective. And it's interesting is because I had someone reacting to a recent episode and the feedback they sent us was, they said, I've heard all these stories. I've heard, you know, what cops have gone through in their careers. And this is the first time I've ever actually heard the entire story of events from the officer's mouth. It's always spun by the department or spun by the news media. And to really hear the things that an officer was frightened or not frightened of, what they were thinking or not thinking of, that's kind of what we're trying to get people to understand. And you've experienced this, I mean, your entire career, you know, almost, 30 plus, almost 40 years in law enforcement, right?
I did 34 years. I did 10 years in a small town called Princeton, New Jersey as a cop, and left there halfway to retirement because I was bored to death. And then I joined the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, where I can assure you I was not bored to death, and did 24 years there.
Yeah, now Vegas Metro, it's unique, right? Because it has kind of a dual status as being both it's almost like it's the sheriff's department and it's the contracted city police department for both the county of Clark and the city of Las Vegas. Is that correct?
Yep. In 1972, the Clark County Sheriff's Department merged with the city of Las Vegas PD to form the Metropolitan Police. And at that time, they decided that the sheriff would be the boss. And then it's kind of an interesting hierarchy. It's a sheriff who's an elected official, of course, has a term of 4 years. And then there are it's an undersheriff, assistant sheriffs, and then deputy chiefs. And that point, it takes the ranks that, you know, are traditional in law enforcement, patrol officer, sergeant, detective, lieutenant, captain, et cetera.
So now when you're out in the unincorporated areas, are they still considered officers, or do they have actual people with the rank of deputy?
No, everybody is an officer, but everybody is a deputy. So
right.
We don't call ourselves deputies. We're police officers, but we ostensibly also are deputy sheriffs.
All right. And I did a little research on you before we sat down. Is it true you were the youngest police officer in the state of New Jersey at one point?
Yes, I was hired at the ripe old age of 19. They had just changed the age of majority from 21 to 18 and didn't take into consideration what that meant. So you could drink and you could vote and you could become a cop. But what you couldn't do was you couldn't buy ammunition because you had to be 21 by federal law. So here I am about to go into the New Jersey State Police Academy, and I had to have my mom go buy my bullets for me.
You know, what's funny is we had an officer that got hired as a reserve officer at 19 years old, and he could carry a gun, but he couldn't buy one.
it's a little crazy. And of course, they realized very quickly that 19 was way too young to be a cop, and they changed the age back to 21.
Now, let me ask you this. We've had this discussion on the show with some other salty cops. What do you think is the perfect age to get into law enforcement? Because I personally realize if I had gotten on the job at 20 or 21, I wouldn't have been as prepared as I was. I ultimately came on the job at about 24, 25. Do you think the age should be raised, or is it personal?
I think 21 is okay. You know, by the time you go through your training, by the time you get off probation, you're going to be 23 years old anyway. You know, the process is pretty long to get hired and then to go through your training period, go through your probationary period. And then it all depends on the individuals. You know, there are a lot of people that are 21 have the maturity. I certainly did not at 19. I thought I did, but I look back on some of the decisions I made as a young cop when the world was very black and white to me. And I look back and I shudder at some of those decisions. But I mean, the reality is that there is no perfect age. Everybody is an individual. People mature at different levels. And believe me, I've known cops who came on at 30 that I wouldn't give you a dime for, and cops came on at 21 who were really squared away. So all depends on the individual, and it depends on the training that they receive and the mentorship and the leadership.
Yeah, one of my greatest mentors, he's now a lieutenant back at my home agency. He once explained the concept of the 20-year rookie to me. And he said, "What's that?" And he says, "It's an officer that can have 20 years on and still make a rookie mistake."
Well, you know what? The reality is that everybody is fallible. We can always have a lapse in judgment. We can always become complacent and make those mistakes, which is one of the interesting things about policing, because nobody's a RoboCop. That's both a curse and a plus, because you know when you take away the personal aspect of law enforcement, you know, that's what makes people shine. There are people that are really good at what they do, and if you take that human element away, then you become an automaton. And actually, I think that's actually one of the issues with body-worn cameras. I'm a fan of them simply because they protect cops more than they protect anyone else. But you know, you act a little bit differently when you have a camera on. And sometimes, you know, what you would have, you know, when you would have used your discretion as a police officer, that discretion is taken away from you if you've got a camera on.
Yeah, that's for certain. I was never a huge fan of the body cameras necessarily, but they do exonerate police officers more than they don't, I would say. If you would you tend to agree?
Oh yeah, which I find very ironic, since the whole political correctness move and politics behind it was to rein in the police and to protect the people from the police, which of course is nonsense. But that was the rallying cry that swept the nation, especially under the Obama administration. We got to protect the people from those mean, racist police. And then, of course, what happens? The evidence from the cameras reveals that most of the cops are doing exactly what they should be doing, and they're doing it well. Which, of course, you don't even hear about body-worn cameras anymore being demanded of cops. And in fact, there are places political activists that have recently come out and said, you know what, we don't want these body-worn cameras. They are a civil rights violation. So it's very interesting how the pendulum is swinging.
Yeah, here, it turns out this tool you wanted does nothing but prove that you guys are actually behaving pretty poorly. Oh, well, let's get rid of it then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There have been protests where the cops have been ordered by the mayors or by the administrations to turn the cameras off because they consider it a civil rights violation for taping people. You know, it's one of those things you can't please all the people all the time. And if you let politics run police agencies, this is the kind of nonsense that happens.
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming with 34 years total in law enforcement,
yep.
And then you've heavily stayed involved in the law enforcement community since retiring. How long have you been retired?
I retired in 2010. Well, it really wasn't something that I had planned to do, quite honestly. I had a stroke in my police car.
You did?
That's what ended my police career.
Wow. How was it? Did they determine it was stress related, or?
Yeah, it was. It was heart. It was heart related. I didn't know that I had a severe heart disease until I had that stroke. But there was a lot of stress. I had recently been involved in a fatal officer involved shooting. My mother had died 3 weeks before in my arms after a protracted illness. And so there was a lot going on at that time, which didn't, you know, help matters any. But I can tell you, this was the most frightening experience of my life. I was in my patrol car. I had a young police officer with me because I was the watch commander that night. Whenever I was watch commander, I would take a patrol officer with me so that he could see that the lieutenant actually did some police work now and then. And also that I could get to know my people that way. So on this particular night, it's 2:30 in the morning, right on the Las Vegas Strip, and I suffered the stroke, and I lost the ability to speak. I lost the ability to move. It was really frightening. I wasn't afraid of dying. I was afraid of living. And once again, the angel who's been sitting on my shoulder for most of my career was there that night as well, and I survived it. But it did end my career.
Yeah, it looks like you've made a full recovery.
Mostly. I've lost some memory, and occasionally I have to reach for a word that I should know. So it did some damage. When they did the brain scan, you can see there are little spots on the brain that have been damaged by the stroke. But for the most part, I'm pretty good.
Now, this leads us nicely into a project that you shared with me that actually is near and dear to my heart because I'm also medically retired from law enforcement. You're working on something called the Wounded Blue. Is that correct?
That is very correct. The Wounded Blue is the National Assistance and Support Organization for Injured and Disabled Law Enforcement Officers. Our official launch is going to be during Police Week in May this year, but we are actually active in that we have a fully trained peer advocate support team made up all of injured and disabled law enforcement officers who assist others who have been injured, disabled, or suffering from post-traumatic stress that need a helping hand and need someone to talk to. We've done hundreds of peer supports. All of my team have been shot, stabbed, beaten, run over, screwed up and screwed over, and they know from whence they speak. Our motto is really important, Tom. Our motto is never forgotten, never alone, because every one of these officers who gets injured feels exactly like that. And we are creating this organization to help improve their lives.
You know, I've met many police officers who have had to medically retire or end their careers sooner than they would have liked to for various medical reasons. And I'll tell you what, it is stunning to me how closely knit a brotherhood can be that then, to some degree, and it's not the rank and file. A lot of times it's the administration and the brass that can turn on you and kind of give up on you as soon as you're not as useful as you once were, I guess, would be the easiest and nicest way to put it without being too vulgar.
Well, I'm a lot more opinionated than you are. I really wish that this organization was not necessary. It's not something I had intended to do. But from being, you know, somewhat of a public figure in the law enforcement community, I kept on being contacted by these desperate men and women who simply had no one else to turn to, and were giving me these horror stories about how they were treated by their own departments once they became severely injured.
Right.
I mean, and I got a taste of it because when I had the stroke in my car that ended my career, my own department didn't pay my medical bills. I had to go to court to force them.
Yeah.
So I understand it because I felt it. How's that for, you know, you serve a community for 24 years, you almost lose your life several times doing it, and then they turn on you and they don't even pay your medical bills, knowing legally that they have to, but they don't. Now, this is for me.
They make you fight it.
They make you fight it. And I was okay because I had 24 years on and I could retire. These young police officers who don't have any time on, they have to literally fight to live, to get treatment. Many police officers don't even get the proper medical treatment because of the systems that are in place. We have to fight that. I created the Wounded Blue to bring unity, to bring compassion, to bring empathy, and to bring awareness to this problem, because America doesn't know it. Even cops don't know it until it happens to them. We just actually created a film called The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed, and it is now available on Amazon. And I urge every single cop and every single person who supports law enforcement to go to Amazon, rent or buy this film, it costs next to nothing, and see what is going on in America and how you can help, because it is shocking.
And where can they get it? Where can they reach Wounded Blue?
Amazon.com, Amazon Prime. You can go to the Amazon.com, put in the Wounded Blue, the film will come up. You either rent it for $1.99, buy it for $9.99, and all the proceeds go to the Wounded Blue, the foundation that I was just telling you about.
And then how can they reach the foundation?
Easy. TheWoundedBlue.org. That's TheWoundedBlue.org. And Facebook, it's The Wounded Blue. Check us out. You'll see all the announcements of what's going on. We got a GoFundMe going on right now. It just started a couple days ago because we have to prepare for our launch in May. And I can tell you that the need is so great that we have to raise substantial money. And it's important to know that everybody involved in this endeavor is a volunteer. Nobody takes any money. I don't take any money. Nobody, none of the directors do. None of the peer team does. This is about saving lives. This is about helping families, because there are nothing for the families of injured officers. We're creating it, and we're starting at the bottom. We are looking for people that want to help in all kinds of ways.
Well, whatever War Stories can do to help bring some exposure to this issue, we're going to certainly jump on board and do. And I'm going to see about getting a lot of our guests who come on to tell their war stories to either donate, or if they have had experiences with being wounded or injured or suffering from PTSD from a critical incident, which, you know, make no mistake, you know, I was involved in a critical incident. Our St. Patrick's Day bonus episode just dropped, and it was when we told the story of our St. Patrick's Day carjacking. And even though I wasn't physically injured, or my partner wasn't physically injured, the nature of that incident just has a lasting effect on you that's a lot of people don't seem to understand or want to understand. So hopefully with Wounded Blue and something like War Stories, we can bring some attention to those issues that people just really aren't aware of. This job is a health hazard.
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt about it. And so post-traumatic stress injury, and that's what, remember that term, post-traumatic stress injury, not post-traumatic stress disorder. Post-traumatic stress does not need to become a disorder.
Right.
It only becomes a disorder when it is ignored. It is an injury like any other injury, and it can be treated as such. And that is really the biggest and most important message. And the Wounded Blue is part of that movement of changing that paradigm. Post-traumatic stress injury is as real as a bullet, but it can be treated and it can be cured. It is part of the human experience. It is natural and normal to when you're trying to process some of the unfathomable things that the men and women of law enforcement see, to deal, your body, your brain deals with it in different ways. And it can be conditioned, it can be reformed into a healthy environment. And post-traumatic stress can be growth as well. It's something that is rarely talked about, but is very true.
Well, because you can have pre-existing issues that are undealt with, and then going through the process of being treated for your post-traumatic stress injury, which I do like that term, because it doesn't, you're right, it doesn't have to become a disorder if it's treated properly. The treatment you get for your post-traumatic stress injury can actually be beneficial to you and help you grow in the other areas of your life that maybe you weren't aware that you were harboring some issues as well. And it's going to save marriages. It's going to save lives. I mean, we talk about veteran suicides, but police suicides are a huge problem in this country.
We've had more than 50 just in the first short months of this year that are confirmed, and there's without a doubt many, many more. But that's one of the reasons why the Wounded Blue is being formed to deal with this, because, you know, when you feel alone, when you feel betrayed, when you feel abandoned, you become hopeless. Hopelessness is what causes law enforcement suicide. And you know, one of the things that is vitally important is to remain part of something bigger than ourselves. Cops are very service-oriented. They're very much mission-oriented. And they want to be a part of something that is bigger than them. That's what the Blue Family is about. Unfortunately, the Blue Family is sometimes so dysfunctional that it doesn't act as a family. So the Wounded Blue is the new Blue Family, if you will.
Yeah, and it is very much ingrained in the law enforcement and even in the first responder and military culture in general, to look at these kinds of cries for help and these kinds of seeking assistance or admitting that something affected you as a weakness. And it's absolutely not a weakness. To think that it's a weakness and to think that it can't get to you is just, that's just a trip down a slippery slope, man. There, but for the grace of God, go any one of us.
That's exactly. And what's really a crime is that there are states that do not even recognize post-traumatic stress injury as a true injury. They don't recognize it as even being real for law enforcement. They'll accept it for military, but they won't accept it for law enforcement. It's stunning to see some of the ways that the states deal with this problem that is as apparent as the nose on anybody's face. But they want to hide their heads in the sand, saying that either A, it doesn't exist, or B, it's not really a true injury. And it's, I mean, there are still places where a police officer could go in and go to their boss and say, look, boss, you know, I'm having some issues dealing with that shooting I was involved in a year ago. And the chief will go, yeah, I'm sorry to hear about that, but, well, you're fired.
Right.
It's shocking. They'll put them on the desk. They'll take away their gun and badge. They'll treat it as a mental illness. And it is really something that needs an organized effort to fight. And that is part of what we do with the Wounded Blue. Our concept here, we call it our SEAL team concept. SEAL stands for support, education, assistance, and legislation, because we need to combat this on all fronts, and we need unity to do it. We need strength. We need numbers. And that's why I urge every police officer to take part in this organization. And not only that, but citizens as well. With the help of the American people, we can make positive changes. And we're creating a membership for the Wounded Blue designed to bring the people and their and the people that they serve together. And the way we're going to do that is by giving incentives to join the organization. If you're a citizen, you get a sticker for your car showing you support law enforcement. You get a driver's license holder so that, that any officer will know you're a supporter of law enforcement. You get discounts to 300,000 businesses across the United States. And then for officers, we've got an entirely different suite of benefits, which include, and you're going to love this because this is the most important thing I think that, that we could ever offer, and that is a mental health component where police officers can get one-on-one assistance with licensed therapists across the country from the privacy of their own home.
Wow.
Video conferencing that their departments or nobody else will ever know. That is probably, we're going to save thousands of lives and families.
Yeah, because the dirty little secret that a lot of people don't want to talk about is that a big, and I'll, I will admit to this myself, a huge stumbling block to getting help is knowing that once you ask for it, your badge and gun can be taken from you and you lose your career and you have nothing left to show for it but shame and embarrassment, because the rest of your blue community, if you're lucky, they'll look at you and pat you on the shoulder and say, you poor bastard. But in a lot of cases, they'll shun you and turn their back on you and forget about you.
Exactly. And this is, you know, this is one of the things that we have to change through education. This is I've actually myself and a catastrophically injured police sergeant from Pennsylvania State Police, Bob Bemis, and I have put together a 4-hour block of instruction for police agencies, police leadership, and police organizations. It's called Walking with the Broken, and it is designed to talk about this topic and show the video, show the film that we have, and then bring to light what is going on and how can we as law enforcement professionals deal with this more compassionately and empathetically to assist our own people.
Right, instead of giving up on them or turning our backs on them and leaving them, you know, like a wagon train, leaving the weak ones in the dust and just taking off because you got no time for them anymore. Well, I assume with 34 years in law enforcement, you yourself have some pretty outstanding war stories. So without further ado, I'm hoping that you've got one that you might lay on us for the show.
I can't. Well, I've written 4 books. I think I can say that I have a few more stories.
Right.
My book, A Cop's Life, which is still in print, available on Amazon, are all stories from my own career. And it's a pretty dark book. It was it's got some pretty heavy stuff in it. And one of the things that I found very interesting was over the years, I've been contacted by no less than 25 cops from around the country telling me, thanking me for writing the book, telling me that they were on the verge of suicide until they read it. And then they realized that they weren't alone in their feelings. And that's when I really started developing an understanding about the issues of post-traumatic stress and about the aloneness that everyone feels when they're suffering by themselves.
Right.
So, I mean, listen, I've got some great stories. Some are inspiring. Some are strange. Some are downright scary. You know, if you look, every cop has moments in their career that were life-changing. And I am no different. I've had several. I've had a number of those life-changing events. But I think one of the ones that probably had the most dramatic effect on my life was surviving a shooting that I probably had no right to survive. And so that's the story I'll tell, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Well, I had left Princeton after 10 years, joined the Metropolitan Police, had to go through the academy again because they didn't take lateral transfers. So I went from being the youngest cop at the time in the state of New Jersey to being an older version for going through the academy. And then I'd start all over as a probationary officer and go through field training. And then I 3 years or so into my career, I was a field training officer. And on this particular night, I was having dinner. It was a Saturday night, 9 o'clock. And I was having dinner with my old partner from patrol. And he and I actually lived together in the academy. He had been a policeman in Wyoming. We met in line when we were being mustered in, and then we wound up living together during the academy, and then wound up as partners when we got out of the academy. So we were very close friends, and we were both training officers. We were having dinner. He had a trainee with him. My trainee was off sick that night, and as we're leaving, we're walking out of the restaurant into the parking lot. The tone alert went off to notify us about a crime in progress or a major incident.
And so for our listeners, the tone alert is a loud beeping noise that goes off to let you know you need to pay attention because something important is about to get told to you, right?
Exactly. So this incident was, we call them now an active shooter. It was a shooting taking place of high school students at a high school dance. And the high school was literally just two blocks from where we were coming out of dinner. And the information, at first, we looked at each other and we go, this doesn't sound real, because the call was a man dressed all in black with a shoulder holster and a pistol, bandoliers of ammunition strapped around him, and a sword and throwing stars.
Oh,
and
Lord.
Yeah, exactly. And we looked at each other going, this is bullshit. That isn't real. But it soon became very apparent that this was the real deal, because there were two couples on a double date following the suspect.
Oh, no.
And they were on the phone with 911 from the cell phone, and they're given the blow-by-blow. Okay, he's shooting at the kids again. They're diving for cover. And then the suspect realized he's being followed by this car. So he turned around, and he shot at them. And the bullet went through the windshield between the heads of the two couples. At that point, the driver decided he'd done his civic duty, and he got the hell out of there. So I have now, I mean, literally, this is happening in seconds. I am on the street where this is taking place. Another patrol unit with a trainee and his training officer get there, and I see them stop their patrol car. They light up the suspect who's walking down the middle of the street with their spotlights and their headlights.
And at this point, he's already been shooting at people, and at this point, he's already hit people?
Well, we didn't know if he'd hit anybody or not, because it was still so dynamic.
Still early on, okay.
Right. So yeah, he's left the high school grounds, which is, you know, half a block away, and now he's walking up the street. As I drive up, I expect to see, and he's literally got the gun in his hand. He's walking towards this police car. And our helicopter has gotten above us, and they're shining their lights on him. And I'm expecting in the next couple seconds that they're going to either shoot the guy, he's going to shoot at them, he's going to run, he's going to commit suicide. One of these things is going to happen. But he does completely the unexpected. He nonchalantly continues to walk towards the police car, puts his gun back in his shoulder holster, and just walks right past him. And the two cops are standing there with the guns out going, oh, shit, that didn't work the way I thought it was going to. And now I've jumped out of my car. The suspect has made a left turn. He's walking up the driveway of an apartment complex. And there's a whole bunch of people standing at the head of the driveway. So he's walking right towards them. And, of course, I can't let him get to them.
No, he's an immediate threat to them. He's already proven he's willing to kill people.
Of course. And you know, this is the moment that every cop trains his entire career for, which generally never happens. And that is the life and death decision that you have to make to use deadly force. Now, I've been trained at State Police Academy in New Jersey. I was a cop for 10 years. I was trained here at the Metro Academy. I was a cop here for 3 years. I have all the tools necessary, but it always comes down to making a personal decision. And so I thought, I don't want to shoot this guy in the back and live with that.
Right.
So I decided I'm going to try and take him physically. So I run up behind him, and he hears me at the last minute, and he turns. And when he turned, I did basically a flying sidekick to his midsection, and I thought that that would knock him down and I could then take him physically. Didn't work like that, unfortunately. When I kicked him, he doubled over, but then he came up with the gun. And we are literally, our muzzles were almost touching when we fired at exactly the same time. And I was not wearing my ballistic armor. And we fired. I saw the muzzle flash of his gun, and I fired two rounds, and then my gun jammed.
Ugh.
And talk about the nightmare of nightmares.
Yeah, you're not wearing a vest, and your gun jams.
Right, and I'm literally face-to-face with this guy.
Now, were vests not required at that point? Or
they were not required.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
So his gun did not jam. And so he and I are standing face-to-face. I'm going click, click, click. He's going boom, boom, boom. And I got nowhere to go because I'm in the middle of a parking lot. My gun stovepiped. I have no place to go. And I'm thinking, this is the moment that I'm going to die. This is what it's like.
Right.
And I'm waiting to feel the impact of the bullets. I roll down onto my back, and I'm trying to clear my weapon, my nine millimeter, and I'm trying to work the mechanism, and he's trying to shoot me, and I'm twisting from side to side, and he's shooting at me. Little pieces of asphalt are hitting me in the head from where the bullets are zinging, the helicopter or air unit saw the go down. So what do they radio? Shots fired, officer
right.
down.
Yeah.
Remember those two cops that were there first? They'd see me go down, and they figure now's a good time to open up on this guy. So now they're shooting right in my direction. I don't know who to be more scared
wow.
of, them or the suspect. But I got my gun working. Now, remember my old partner?
Uh-huh. The okay. one that you went to from Wisconsin or Wyoming or something?
Yeah. So he hears the shots fired, officer down. He's driving in. He sees the suspect standing over me, and he decides he's going to run him over. So he aims his police car. But what happens in a critical incident? You lose auditory function sometimes, yep. and also you get tunnel vision. So he was focused on the suspect, but he didn't see these big cement stanchions that were in the way. So he aims his police car. Theory was good. And then he totaled out his police car as he smashed against the big cement stanchions. But what it did do, it took the suspect's attention away from me long enough to get up and re-engage him. I've now got my weapon working, and now he and I are shooting it out again. And as we're shooting it out, I'm thinking I'm the world's worst shot because nothing – I must be missing this guy.
Right.
Because nothing is slowing him down. He's not a big guy. He's only – I think he was 145 pounds and 5'6". And I run out of ammunition. I do a combat reload. We're still shooting it out. And then he turns and he runs. I run after him. My old partner runs after him. Oh, by the way, his rookie officer, when he hit the cement stanchions, she jumped out of the police car, fired one round that went into the police car, and then she dropped her gun and started crying. That was her last night as a police officer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's an interesting, you know, aside to the story is you really, no matter how much training you have, you really never know how you're going to react until it happens.
Right.
So all the training in the world, if it's not reality-based training, it's theoretical. And then when the shit hits the fan, it's not it can sometimes have what happened here. And that is this officer was not prepared to be a police officer.
Right. So
that's just an aside. So the suspect runs. I chase him. My old partner chases him. he hides behind a bush, and as we are approaching, I hear him scream, "Die, motherfucker, die." And I remember thinking, this guy's crazy. Right. And we opened up on that bush, and that did it. We wound up, when they did the autopsy, he had 43 gunshot wounds.
Well, couldn't have happened to a nicer guy.
My first two shots were fatal wounds, but he didn't know it. So when you hear all this nonsense on the media, well, why did they have to shoot him so many times? Well, because the guy's dead and doesn't know it.
Right.
And that's the reality. So fast forward 10 years. My old partner and I never talked about that night. After that happened, and he and I are close friends to this day. But we never talked about that night again for 10 years.
And then now, real quick, do you know why you never talked about it, or did it never came up, or you both think you avoided it?
I think we both avoided it.
Okay.
That's what I think, you know, in retrospect. He and I went out one night and we're sitting at a bar, and for it came up. And I remember I was looking at him in the mirror of the bar and we're talking about it. And I said to him, "How about that crazy son of a bitch screaming out, 'Die, motherfucker, die.'" And I looked at him in the mirror and he's just staring at me, not saying anything. And I turned to him, I said, "What are you looking at?" The New Jersey came out in me. "What are you looking at?" And he looked at me, he says, you really don't know, do you?" And I said, "Know what?" He said, "He never said a word. That was you."
Wow.
And I never knew it till that day. So think of this. Think if that incident had happened today and somebody caught me on video screaming, "Die, motherfucker, die," as I unloaded my gun into a guy.
You're roasted.
Totally.
Yep. You were going to be sacrificed on the altar of political correctness by the administration faster than you can turn in your badge and gun.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why when I tell this story to administrators and to cops, you never know. When you are in the heat of combat, you cannot be judged by the civil type of political correctness, because there is no understanding of it. When you're in combat, you're in combat.
Right. There's no marquee of Queensberry rules.
Yeah. And yet I know, as sure as you just said, if that happened today, I'd probably be in prison.
Yeah. They would have said it was intentional homicide and you would have just been sacrificed to the Twitter gods because of all the outrage and public outcry from people that have no business commenting, quite frankly.
Yeah, exactly. But that night changed my life, because I wondered, and this journey still continues for me, the journey of why. Why did I survive and he not? By every convention, I should have been hit that night. Why didn't I? Why was I chosen to survive it? And so that provoked an incredible amount of thought that still continues to this day. And I think that I came up with my understanding of why I didn't die.
Lay it on me.
And that is because I had not completed the mission. I had not completed the mission that I was put here for. Now, I'm not a very religious guy. I consider myself spiritual, but I don't follow a particularly regular, you know, religious type of experience. But I believe that I had not completed my mission. And so I was left here to do that. But of course, then that begins the next question. Okay, Randy, what's your mission?
Right.
And I believe that I came up with that answer as well. And that is, I was put here to touch the lives of the people that I respect the most, and that is the American law enforcement officer. And so I have dedicated my life to that end for my entire career, and that continues to this day.
Well, with four books, and being the executive producer of the Wounded Blue documentary and running the Wounded Blue Foundation and all your speaking engagements and all your Blue Lives Radio. And now my understanding is you just launched a show as well.
Yeah, this is pretty exciting. There is a brand new streaming network that was started by two veterans, combat veterans, called Ops Lens, OPSLENS. And you can download that app. It's the Ops Lens app. And they are they've already got over 1 million followers from producing their own a couple of television shows that they have put on different platforms. Well, now they've created their own streaming network, and they are creating something that's going to be, I think, really powerful. Streaming TV, of course, has become more popular than broadcast TV. They're bringing on 17 new shows. Mine is one of them. It's called True Blue, the Voice of American Law Enforcement, on Ops Lens TV. And we've just done our third episode. It's a weekly show, but it's available anytime you want to see it. Just download the Ops Lens app. And the introduction to this is very simple. And that is American law enforcement has been at the forefront of news stories about crime and social change for years. But the mainstream media, political activists, and their agenda-driven elected officials have driven the narrative about law enforcement in America. Now it is time for the truth about the stories you read in the headlines and the men and women who each and every day risk their lives to protect and serve. And this is True Blue, the Voice of American Law Enforcement. And that is part of my mission.
So it sounds like you spent 34 years protecting the public and then realized that although protecting the public was going to prepare you for your mission, that your actual mission now is to help the men and women who are now protecting the American public, especially in this ever daily changing of atmosphere of American law enforcement. It is changing so rapidly, and I think the young cops coming up are going to have a harder time adjusting to this new normal. So it sounds like you've positioned yourself to now help them navigate that and be a voice for them, and both in the public and, you know, an advocate to them for their own department.
That's exactly right. And, you know, you put it very well. In fact, I'm going to steal that from you.
You got it.
I spent 34 years protecting the public, and now I'm protecting the law enforcement officer. That's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah. 34 years of training for your mission to finally begin. It sounds like that's amazing. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, where can people find you? Are you on Facebook? I know you're on Facebook. You have randysuttonspeaks.com. It's randysuttonspeaks, all one word, .com, correct?
That's correct.
That, yep. They can contact you for speaking engagements and find out more about your books. You're on Facebook?
I am. I am on Facebook under the Voice of American Law Enforcement.
Got it. And
Twitter, at LT Randy Sutton.
Okay. And then are you on the Instagram at all?
You know what? I am, but I rarely use it.
Okay. So if you're going to try and reach out to Randy, do so on Twitter or Facebook or randysuttonspeaks.com. What do you see is the biggest hurdle facing American law enforcement externally at this point? What in this ever-changing climate of we hate cops?
Firemen.
You know,
and weak police leadership.
That one's killing me.
It's stunning. It really is. I mean, when I watched I really became very vocal under the Obama administration with the way that he had weaponized the Department of Justice against law enforcement. And literally, you know, raised the banner of anti-law enforcement rhetoric to the point where people felt emboldened enough to actively confront law enforcement and then create this environment. And then the surge in social media challenges to law enforcement that then became part of the narrative. The greatest lie ever perpetuated against law enforcement, hands up, don't shoot, which is still being embraced by politicians and members of activist groups, that even though it never happened.
Yep, never happened. Same thing with the guy who was saying, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," to which I have repeatedly told people from experience, applying the carotid restraint to many a bad guy's neck, if you can say to me, "I can't breathe," you can breathe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and of course, this is why what I do is so important, because we kind of got a little bit off track in that leadership, law enforcement leadership was time. You didn't see anybody from the International Association of Chiefs of Police out there in the forefront in the media defending officers. You didn't see anybody of any command rank other than the Milwaukee County Sheriff, who came out very publicly and represented law enforcement well. He and I were basically the only people that were out there in the public view defending law enforcement. And so the leadership of these organizations, you know, you see them throwing cops to the wolves all the time. Not only that, but you have activist prosecutors now who are I call them persecution by prosecution, taking justified shootings and charging them anyway, charging law enforcement officers anyway, in order to garner votes and to pander to their political base.
Right.
This is something I've never seen before. I never thought we would ever be here. But this is something that, you know, the voice of American law enforcement, in my guise of representing, you know, the true police officer in the media, this is what I do. I consider myself a translator to the American public of why police do what they do, because it's not explained to them anywhere else. And it takes a cop to explain it.
Right.
But unfortunately, there's a lot of media outlets that will not allow that to happen. In fact, I can tell you that I was literally censored by CNN during one of these major protests. They came to me. It was right after the Dallas police shooting, the massacre of those Dallas cops, which was, you know, has changed law enforcement forever.
Right.
They set up an interview with me, and date, time, we're ready to rock and roll. And then the producer called me and did something I've never had done before or since. They asked me how I was going to answer the questions. And I was stupid because I told them. And they canceled the interview because they didn't really want the real response. They instead got one of their tame experts, quote unquote, to give them the party line. Wow. And that's the reality that mainstream media is very often censoring the law enforcement voice.
Yeah, if you don't fit into their narrative of cops are racist and evil, then they want to hear about it. And the reality is cops aren't racist or evil. They are sheepdogs protecting the sheep, and most of them just want to keep you safe. They really, I would say 99.9% of law enforcement are doing it right all the time. And I will routinely share articles about law enforcement shenanigans or about dirty cops getting busted, because I think it's important that we as a community expose them. Because what most people don't know is that the people that hate dirty cops the most, the people that hate cops that do it wrong the most, are cops.
Of course.
You know, it's amazing to me. So I really appreciate what you're doing. You seem like you're standing up for law enforcement. So I think that as a law enforcement community, we need to stand up and support you while you support the men and women who are out there doing it every day. I don't do it every day anymore. And to be quite frank, as I see what goes on in the media, I miss the job, but I don't miss that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't miss what they're going through. But I appreciate you coming on and telling us your war story. That's amazing. And ironically enough, as I was preparing for this interview, I watched a couple of clips of you on Cops. And one of the first clips I came across was a clip of you at the range. Do you, and I don't know if you remember this, but they were filming you at the range, and you had just transitioned to what looked like a 4506.
Right after the shooting. That yeah. is exactly right.
So you were telling a story about how you shot a guy with a 9mm and nothing was happening, and so you switched to a 45 because you decided you need to, you know, have more stopping power. And so as you told that story, I thought to myself, I wonder if that's exactly what he was talking about.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about, and I carried a 45 for the rest of my career.
Yeah, my old man, I quote him all the time because he was one of my greatest law enforcement mentors. He said, why throw a BB when you can throw a bowling ball? So
exactly.
I appreciate you coming on, Randy. I want to stay in touch with you because I want to find out how myself personally can help with Wounded Blue, because it's close to my heart, you know, having medically retired. But also I want to make sure that our War Stories podcast is growing by leaps and bounds right now. Whatever we can do to help you, whatever we can do to raise awareness, anywhere that we can put the message out there, we want to, because I really think you're doing the Lord's work, and I appreciate everything that you're doing for law enforcement out there today.
I appreciate that, and I need all the help I can get in making the Wounded Blue a success. That includes financial help, but also help from the men and women of law enforcement who are in need. You know, remember, our resource is for you, whether you have been injured or disabled, or you're suffering from issues involving the job. We all face those issues. It's sometimes great to have somebody that you can just talk to. And that's what my peer team does. That's what we do.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Randy Sutton, follow him on Facebook and follow him on Twitter. You can catch him on Fox and Friends. You can catch him in the documentary, The Wounded Blue. And go check out RandySuttonSpeaks.com. Also check out the Wounded Blue documentary on Amazon and Amazon Prime. Now that I know where to find it, I'm going to go watch it. I watched the trailer. I got excited for it. And now I'm going to go watch the actual documentary today. So I appreciate you coming on. Thanks, Randy.
My pleasure. Okay.